You're listening to Backstage at Lyric, the podcast that takes you behind the curtain at Lyric Opera of Chicago. Backstage at Lyric features in-depth interviews with the singers, conductors, and creative minds behind the productions in the 2007-2008 season. For additional interactive content and to order tickets, visit us online at lyricopera.org.
Soprano Danielle Denise and conductor Emmanuel Chaim are backstage at Lyric.
There are some roles in your life when you know, we learn so much music and prepare so many things over time, but there are certain roles that when you kind of look at them and start to explore them, you just know that they're going to be very close to you for your whole life, and Cleopatra is one of those roles.
Thank you for downloading this episode of Backstage at Lyric, the podcast that takes you behind the scenes at one of the world's great opera companies. I'm Roger Pines of Lyric Opera of Chicago. For this episode, we're playing an audio transcript of the Lyric Opera Discovery Series session for Julius Caesar. For those of you who may not be aware of the Discovery Series, it's panel discussions featuring singers, conductors, directors, and opera experts. We present one session per opera. They usually take place a few days prior to the opening of the production. The Discovery Series is open to the public, and it's a great way to get up close and personal with our artists. You can check out our website at www.lyricopera.org for dates, tickets, and complete Discovery Series information. We're including all the Discovery Series sessions as part of the Backstage at Lyric podcast. And now, on to the Discovery Series panel featuring Danielle Denise and Emmanuel Chaim. I'm your host for this session, and I hope you enjoy it.
Good evening, everyone. I'm Roger Pines, dramaturg at Lyric Opera Chicago. Welcome to our Discovery Series session on Handel's Giulio Cesare, Julius Caesar. David Daniels is unwell and regretfully has had to decline our invitation to participate in tonight's discussion. Our two guests this evening have extraordinarily impressive biographies. You'll be able to read all about them in the program of the production, which I assume you'll all be seeing in one of its eight performances. So to just give you the basic details, soprano Danielle Denise is making her Lyric debut as Cleopatra. After creating a sensation in the premiere of David McVicker's Glyndebourne production of Giulio Cesare in 2005, she recorded it on DVD and reprised it in 2006. She's also sung Cleopatra in Amsterdam, Paris, and at the Metropolitan Opera, where she debuted in Le Nozze di Figaro at the age of 19. She's made a specialty of Handel, including the leading soprano roles in Semele, Rodelinda, and most recently at Paris's Théâtre des Champs-Élysées, Ariodante. Brand new on the Decca label is her first solo CD, which is an all-Handel program with William Christie conducting Les Arts Florissants. When Danielle returns to Glyndebourne in 2008 for a new production of The Coronation of Poppea, she will be renewing her collaboration with this evening's second guest. French conductor Emmanuel Chaim led Glyndebourne's 2006 Giulio Cesare and was also on the podium when that production was remounted by the Opéra de Lille. Chicago audiences will remember her from Handel's Agrippina at Chicago Opera Theater. She began her career as one of her generation's most gifted harpsichordists. She now regularly leads performances with many of the world's most celebrated original instrument ensembles. One of them is Le Concert d'Astrée, which she founded and has directed for 6 years. She also conducts modern instrument orchestras and made a very successful debut earlier this year with the Deutsche Symphonieorchester in Berlin. With Le Concert d'Astrée, she's building an impressive discography, collaborating with such artists as Nathalie Dessay, Ian Bostridge, and Rolando Villazon. So please join me in welcoming to the Discovery Series Danielle Denise and Emmanuel Chaim. Lyric was already more than 30 years old before we did any Handel, but since 1995, we have had Xerxes and Alcina, Partenope, and now Giulio Cesare. And the same sort of thing, I think, is happening in major companies all over the world. So the basic question for both of you to start this off is, What is it about Handel that has finally inspired opera companies to stage his operas regularly? So what are they discovering about him that they seem to ignore before? Who wants to start?
Why don't you start?
Handel music is so communicative, it's so good in theater, in painting characters, and so joyful that it's just that at last it comes to all those major companies and can be presented to the audience. And as we can see, this is very popular music, and the access to it is very immediate because it's a very passionate music. Don't you think, Danielle?
Yeah, I think also there is... I think music also comes in waves. You know, there are sort of phases where there's a resurgence of a certain composer's music. And I'd say definitely in the past 25 years, the early music and Baroque music mm-hmm. has really come back to the front of this of the music scene with, you know, so many names like you and, you know, many other Baroque conductors that are coming out and doing really great, authentic period practice. So, and there are also so many great singers out there as well that are really taking the practice of early music performance to a very high level, like David Daniels. So I think it's a combination of many things. Emmanuel's absolutely right that there is a timeless quality to his music. Handel was one of the greatest, I guess if you put it in kind of modern terms, songwriters of his era. And he has that power kind of, you know, in terms of creating a melody that stays with you and that just pulls on your heartstrings. I think that is something so special about what he writes and the way he writes.
When did you both discover that Handel fit your particular abilities? Was there one piece that was so exciting to you that it made you want to explore his music in greater depth? Did you have some sort of revelatory experience to say, this is my man, this is the person that I want to spend a lot of my musical life with?
I used to always sing, as a teenager, one of the first Handel arias that I ever sang was Piangero.
From Giulio Cesare,
which, you know, it's a bit strange to imagine a teenager singing Piangero, which means I will weep. But I loved that aria, and that was one of the first things that I did of Handel. I didn't set out to become a, you know, quote-unquote specialist in early music repertoire, but one of the first auditions that I did in my freshman year of college was for the Netherlands Opera, and I was given the role of Cleopatra to debut in Europe at the age of 21. So it was 3 years in advance, and that was really the first Baroque role that I did, and, you know, then the love affair began. So,
Emmanuel, how did you discover Handel?
Again, like Danielle, it was during my studies. And because, as she says, the melodies are so good, it's quite often that you are given some of his melodies to harmonize. If you work on a harmony, you will be given his melody and try to write what fits well with it. And one of my harmony teacher gave us the La Sciacchiopianga that probably everybody knows, but it's such a fantastically simple, perfect melody that also goes so well with the words. And that was actually one of my first meetings with Handel. And since then, I mean, I've explored a lot of his music, the very early works that are extremely striking to me, because he was about Danielle's age when she started singing it. But like when he was 21, when he arrived in Italy and wrote his very first masterpieces like Resurrezione or Triumph of Time or Dixit Dominus, and until, if you go at the other end, like Jephthé or Theodora, yes, or all those the English oratorios, and there is such a variety of inspiration in throughout his life. It's quite amazing how different a person he can be when you actually explore all his work. And I imagine I will have some more years to really look into everything.
Before we discuss Giulio Cesare in detail, I need to do my 60-second review of the story just to refresh all of your memories. So here we go. And ladies, I hope I get it accurately. Julius Caesar has conquered the army of his political rival, Pompey. After triumphantly arriving on Egypt's shores, he's appalled when the head of Pompey is brought to him as a gift from Ptolemy, who rules Egypt with his sister Cleopatra. Cleopatra is well aware of her brother's ambition to become sole ruler. She decides to seek Caesar's support. Disguised as her lady-in-waiting, the noble Lydia, she enchants Caesar with her beauty. Meanwhile, Sextus, the son of Pompey, is longing to avenge his father's murder. He attempts to battle Ptolemy, but he's arrested and imprisoned. Sextus's mother, Cornelia, is forced to join Ptolemy's harem. Caesar is enjoying the affections of Lydia when his enemies ambush him. After Cleopatra reveals her true identity to him, he rushes off into battle but is presumed dead. Ptolemy's forces eventually fight those of Cleopatra, who is defeated and led away in chains. Caesar has survived after all. Cleopatra's about to kill herself, but she's reunited with Caesar just in time. Sextus finally rescues his mother and kills Ptolemy. Then, proclaiming their love, Caesar and Cleopatra bring peace to Egypt once again. So, Danielle, how did the role of Cleopatra, how did the character of Cleopatra come into your life? We already know that you auditioned for the role very early, but how did the figure of Cleopatra herself come into your life?
It really came through preparing the role and kind of starting, as I said, with Piangero. I obviously knew about Cleopatra as a young girl, you know, studying history and things like that, but I didn't really dig deep into research until I started to prepare the music. And there are some roles in your life when you know, we learn so much music and prepare so many things over time, but there are certain roles that when you kind of look at them and start to explore them, you just know that they're going to be very close to you for your whole life. And Cleopatra is one of those roles. So I knew, you know, the moment that I started to sing even Piangero, and then as I looked through all the arias, and one of the great things about singing a Handel role is that you have a great arc of emotion that you can explore, because you don't just go on and sing one aria, especially Cleopatra, who has about 8 arias. You really get a chance to really explore all of the emotional content that is there in the music, but also in the character. And that comes also by looking at the text and translating, you know, an entire score, which does take time, especially if you don't speak the language. And that really was how I first came upon Cleopatra. But I mean, we're, as Emmanuel said, we're always looking again, looking with new eyes, appreciating something in a different way. So even though one has done the role or conducted in the opera once or twice or 3 times, you can really look at it always in a fresh way with new perspective.
Emmanuel, you'd conducted other Handel operas prior to Cesare. I think you began with Rodelinda, correct? Is that your first? Did you feel, though, a particular attraction to this piece, or did it come to you almost by accident?
No. I mean, of course, I knew the piece because it's famous with reason. As Daniel says, the music in Caesar is so varied, because there are moments of lightness and humor, moments of depth, really, moment of despair, moment of passion, moment of bravura, of heroism, of historical, of plot, of intrigues. So he has a very subtle way of describing all that within a range which seems restricted, like the opera seria with its form is seems restricted. It looks like alternating recits and arias, and so therefore one would think it is not varied enough, but his way of renewing this form is absolutely extraordinary. Now, talking about César is En Rodelinda, happened to have been written the same year, 1724, as well as Tamerlano, and it's amazing how within the same form, the same orchestration, the same singers, almost like soprano, castrati, which we don't have really, but
really?
Just a detail. how it can go for a quite dark, deep tragedy with Rodelinda. Tamerlano is just inside drama for a few characters, making all of them completely crazy. And César is a mixture of all that historical, but also funny plays. And it's quite extraordinary how the piece is striking you. And I hope for an audience point of view as well.
There's so much more to the Cleopatra of Handel, I think, than what we know of her from other versions of the character that we've witnessed, whether in theater or on film. So, Danielle, you studied up on the historical Cleopatra in a big way. So what did you learn about her, about the historical figure, that helped you the most when you began playing her on the stage?
There was a couple of things that still resonate with me from that research that have really helped me in just knowing the information. It's not really about kind of showing whether you know the information, but just knowing makes all the difference. So, and one of the things was, you know, there's this great scene when Sesto sings Cara Speme, mm-hmm. and he's, you know, talking about avenging his father's death, and you know, bringing back honor to his family and his family's name and to his father's name. And as Cleopatra, in that time when her father was killed in Rome, she did not have time to even mourn the father's death because already her power was hanging in the balance between the brother. And looking at that, having read up on that and knowing that little piece of information just gave me a completely different perspective on Cara Speme, mm-hmm. and looking at the difference between the Egyptian rites and rituals and Roman rites and rituals. And I mean, there's many things, really. The fact that she was such an incredibly strong and intelligent youthful person. So, I mean, we're talking about a young girl, 17, 18 years of age. And what's in the music that I think relates so much historically is that playful side, I think, as well. Because these were children playing with power. And I love that this production explores that and really embraces what is in the music, especially Cleopatra's first two arias, which really have, you know, they're very engaging. And they embrace the childlike side of her. And then, you know, you can go all the way to Se Pietà or Piangerò, which really embrace the adult that comes out of her. And out of youth, sometimes maturity can evolve. And the opera gives you a chance to really see her evolve as a character.
Handel was dealing so often with mythical figures, legendary figures, and yet here he's actually presenting people not only who actually lived, but were the most powerful rulers of their time, that is César and Cleopatra. So in their story, do we see any situations or qualities of these characters that we could actually transplant into the modern world?
Surely, I guess, like... Yeah. Timeless plays. What is interesting also in Handel possibilities is the fact that he presents us historical characters, but in a very intimate moments of their life, and not only public ways of their life. So it's all of a sudden looking into, yes, rulers of the world, but into their love affairs and disputes and little disputes with her brother, for example. That surely applies to nowadays personalities. Which ones?
I think also, I mean, I would say every Handel opera and text is really about people. And I think that there's most of the kind of qualities that are examined in the piece can be identified with by a modern audience, because we're talking about people who are young, people who are ambitious, who want power, who want control. Caesar's an older man who is slightly, you know, flailing, and insecurity, and those things I think we can relate to even today. You know, they have this very strange sister-brother incestuous relationship between Cleopatra and Ptolemy, which maybe we cannot relate to today. Yes. But yeah, there are many, many qualities, and love, and political alliance, I think, is another really important aspect of the story of Cleopatra and Caesar. And how she looks to him at first with an agenda and then finds herself much more committed and engaged than she ever thought. So she's attracted to the man as well as the power.
Emmanuel, you spoke to me several weeks ago about what a remarkable drama this actually is. Now, what makes Handel such a splendid musical dramatist?
Is helped also by his librettist, who, in this case, Nicolas Haïm.
No relation.
Not that I've been told. But, who knows? I think the what is quite incredible, if you read the text before you really know the opera and the play, and just would imagine what would be the lines he's going to pick up to do an aria, and what are the ones where he's going to have the action more coming. And that's quite interesting. Before you would, I mean, of course, you know the piece a bit, sometimes very well before, but it's very interesting what is it he chooses to underline more and to give emphasis to. And that's where you can read his really dramatic qualities. How does he times all this? And before he goes to the very dramatic arias of Cleopatra, for example, how does he present her to us? What aspects of her do we see first? Yes, her playful and childish personality and a little bit spoiled. And then her, she's a bit meanful. How do you say, Liam?
Manipulative.
Yes, and she's ambitious and she's seductive, but all of a sudden she's fragile. And then we see her, oh, she's in despair, and now she's really somebody that you can see. And that's what you can, the choice of the words. And I think they did work really hand in hand, both of them, with the librettist. And we know that there were changes in the adaptations of librettis. How did he adapt that? And that's his main qualities. Also, in terms of orchestration, he quite intelligently balances. You would have, for example, the beginning of the whole opera. You've got a very demonstrative full orchestra with horns to have the arrival of Caesar. And then you gradually would have the presence of the flutes for some of the two disparate arias, her piangero, but Cornelia's mourning on her husband's death would be accompanied by the lonely flute, and then you would have very centrally placed the aria of dissimulation of Caesar, the Vatacito, so well known, with a brave horn showing us all the possibilities of dissimulation will be illustrated by him. Then the stage band orchestra is going to be the orchestration of seduction. This is so well thought within a tiny orchestra, if you would look at it on the whole. I mean, it's like 40 people in total. It's not that much, that many people. And yet, such a variety and a dramatic way of orchestrating a piece. That's what I think of his capacities, really.
Everybody thinks of Handel in terms of arias, and there are more than 30 arias in this piece, but there's also a great deal of recitative. So before we get to the arias, we need to talk a bit, I think, about that and how the drama itself happens within the recitative. So I think a lot of singers and conductors can't wait to get through the recits and move into the arias, but you both... You as a conductor and harpsichordist Emmanuel, Danielle, you as a singer, both seem to relish recitatives. So when you began to perform this repertoire, did the recitatives come naturally to you, or was it a very interesting learning process that you went through in terms of acquiring this style?
I must say one thing. When I was a kid and my mom was listening to Mozart operas in the salon, and when recits were coming, I was passing the door, I was like, and I was closing the door because I hated it. And especially that weird instrument thing, ning, ning, ning. Oh, I hated it, the harpsichord. I was about 7, 8 years old, and I was really a mean little one, and I didn't like it. And strangely, when I discovered all the richness and the possibilities of acting and reacting and accompanying that with what is called the continuo group, which is like the underlining of their words of a dramatic situation, which is just either lightly shadowed or heavily dramatized.
Emmanuel, we have a continuo group in our Cesare of what, 6 players altogether?
1, 2, 3, 4. Yeah, exactly.
2 harpsichords.
Yes. Yeah.
And
one lute.
Yes. And what else?
2 celli and 1 double bass.
Okay.
So there are the baddies get the double bass. And the nice ones get the lute.
The romantic ones.
Yes. Danielle, how did you come to enjoy doing recitative, or did you enjoy it from the start?
I honestly always enjoyed it because recitative is, in a sense... maybe I shouldn't say more important, but it is as important as the arias. It's also where a lot of the action moves forward. The story is told in the recits, really. The emotion is explained in the arias. So without recits, we don't have an opera, basically. We don't have a story if we take out the recits and just do a kind of concise version with just, you know, I don't know, A sections. And it's also, it's very interesting to study recits and to look at how you can vary them. As Emmanuel was saying, the continuo is there. And it's a collaboration. So they are there also to create atmosphere and color in the same way that it is my job as a singer to color my text based on the emotions that I want to convey. So it's not even as black and white as just looking at the words and then coloring what's based on what word you're singing, but actually what your intention is. And we've had so much fun kind of looking at recits now, having done Cleopatra twice with Emmanuel, and looking at how one can say the same thing in very different ways, at different speeds, even really change the effect that a recitative can have. And I've noticed that we've done things in the two times, we've changed a lot of things, and that's great because it really breathes. In the same way that when we speak to each other, you know, on a daily basis, we can say the same words but in very different ways, and a recitative is exactly the same. The only thing that stays the same is the text and the notes. But there are so many different varieties and ways in which one can convey that, that you never really do it this... I don't do it the same way twice. I'm always kind of thinking in a different way, processing things on stage in a different way, and really reacting in real time. So it means also that the continuo really has to be on their toes and be watching, because one will not always react in the same way, as we know.
Yes, and also simply because, as Daniel says, a recit is text, basically. Happens to be with notes and yes, harmonies that will underline or emphasize more a word, but she says, oh, you're breaking my heart. So she says, oddio il cor mi struggi. And so that's going to be, oddio il cor mi struggi. It's Sprechgesang somehow. It is sung, but it's more talking than really sung. And therefore, you've got a same freedom to be, rhythmically speaking, as free as possible, as you would be in a talk.
Yeah.
It is a theatrical talk, so it's not exactly the way you would talk at home. I mean, mind you, maybe you say...
Maybe. No, but when the recit really comes off the page, really, is when you get to that point in studies where the way in which you sing a recitative doesn't actually sound like notes. And if you're doing it well, then it's just,
it's really words.
The voice just comes out of the text and it's on that note. And when you can really, I think that's when it really becomes live drama and action, is when you're not aware of a person singing notes, but actually singing emotions and singing feelings.
And that's, I mean, quite remarkable, because with somebody like Dani, she didn't mention, but she actually speaks perfect Italian. So on top of it, it makes a big difference when you've got somebody who has a knowledge of the language they are singing and who has theatrical qualities. I mean, you can sometimes not talk all the languages that you are singing, but it does help quite a lot, and it's helpful. And in this, the stage director has to be very present, because he's also the one driving. We've got to be hand in hand, him, me, and the actors or singers or actors singers, as you want, who will be directed in a way or another, bring their own ideas, of course, but being in one same play, basically, like actors.
Yeah.
There are only two duets in this opera, otherwise it's all arias. And Danielle, I suppose you have twice, if not three times, as many arias as you would have in any role you would do in the standard repertoire.
Yes.
Do you find that Handel is really able to create the kind of variety that you're craving, so that each aria really has its own distinct character?
Yes. I mean, and that also comes from the text, and it comes from the color that Handel paints different emotions, which is something that he was so, so good at. His strength was really taking that Italian, 18th century Italian da capo aria and turning it into a small gem, each and every single one. I mean, I do feel sometimes I wish I could sing other roles as well as Cleopatra, because, you know, I want to sing Sesto, or, you know, there are so many wonderful arias in Giulio Cesare, and that's just one of the operas that he wrote. So it's just very special to be able to perform Handel on stage, even, and have the chance to do that.
I've always felt that his music was the healthiest music a singer could possibly perform. Do you agree with that?
Yes, I feel very healthy when I sing Handel. In this performance, I have to say, it's very taxing because I'm also dancing at the same time. So I will say that I come out at the end of the performance and I'm probably not going to want to sing any more Handel arias that night. But it's very healthy for the voice. Mozart as well, I find. Handel and Mozart for me are two composers that I'm performing a lot. And I feel they are very therapeutic to my little vocal cords, and it's like a massage or something. It's very when you're singing it well, of course. If you don't have a good technique, you can sing anything and it can be unhealthy for you. But Handel, the way in which he writes lends itself to good singing because it's all about line, and he doesn't kind of write phrases that are just humanly impossible to do. That doesn't mean they're not difficult, but they are comfortable. Once you kind of master how it is that you want to perform it, then, you know, he was great with that.
Emmanuel, I know you count on your work in Baroque opera being an act of real collaboration with your artists. So can we talk about that, the kind of collaborative work that you do with your artists in rehearsal, and how that collaboration continues once you've got them on stage?
Yeah. When you look at this score, and yes, looking into this music, those arias, there are so many ways in seeing one aria, and I find that the best way with a singer is to go along with the person and to try to find the same understanding of the piece together. And also the more adapted to the person. So sometimes it's not even with words. We play together when it's a person that has a lot of experience in this repertoire and is able even to improvise and find ornaments also that would be adapted either to the dramatic moment or to the feelings that should be expressed or that she feels or that he feels at that moment. We adopt it and we take it, and then sometimes I would suggest things. In this case, we've done the production together, and in the case of Danielle, she sang the role quite a lot, so she has a knowledge of this music that makes the collaboration starting at a very high point, which is very, very, very nice. When you come with a singer that is singing a role for the very first time, a Handelian role for a very first time, it's very demanding to do it within the time of the production because it's short, and somebody has to absorb already pacing oneself to sing a full role, then ornamented it, which is so demanding because it's a third part of the role, and you've got to integrate it within a production, and they have to fit together. In this case, for example, with choreography, some of the ornaments are even choreographed. Yeah. So it's it was kind of created together. Not that it cannot move, because it's we have changed things around. Yeah. And worked on it together. So I really think it has to be done hand in hand to really fit the singer, and so that we go in the same path. I try either when it is in theater like this, but when you do understand somebody well, it's okay. It's done on it does itself without many words. You play it a few times together, and you do adjust here and somebody there, and we find a way. We just find a way of collaborating. When it's on concert, you have less time. I try to work with the singers or other players long before we read the music. We let it then
absorb.
We see each other, we think of it a bit more, we And that's sometimes a time that I need, they need, we need together, and that's it.
Now, this leads directly into a topic that you have to get to in any discussion of Handel Opera, and that is ornamentation. Danielle is rather remarkable in her ornamentation that she writes most of it herself, which I think is the most extraordinary achievement. So, Danielle, what are your criteria for what makes an ornament effective in context?
Well, I go straight from the text. So I tend not to do ornaments. I tend personally to be on the side of more being faithful to the emotional and dramatic impulse of what I want to say and finding an ornament that fits that, which is a lot like what you were just talking about. I have to say one of the great things about working with Emmanuel is that the collaboration starts together. So there are some conductors that in the Baroque world that will send you ornaments a few months before, and they might have nothing to do with the production, and they might not even know your voice. Maybe you've never worked with them before, and you get some papers that have notes on it that you need to be able to sing, and it's not related at all to what you're going to do on stage. So that can be very, very challenging and not my favorite thing to do. And what's really great about working with Emmanuel is that, you know, we've gotten together, you know, at the piano a few times, and we just play through things and create. And she is an incredible ornament writer. So we have actually used quite a few of Emmanuel's ornaments in redoing the piece. And that's what's great about the piece is that even though it's choreographed, we can still work new things into it and do new ornaments. One of the other great things, for example, in Se Pietà, we have the Da Capo that is entirely different from when the production was premiered at Glyndebourne in 2005. And we took great liberties with creating in that and found completely different colors for the same text and the same music. So, yeah, my criteria really is just going on the emotion. And if something doesn't feel comfortable, or I sometimes, if something feels like I'm just trying to show off or something too much, then I often take it right out because I don't feel that that's doing the right service to the text and to the emotion. I'd much rather service that than service another aspect of Da Capo ornamentation, which is the virtuoso, the kind of exhibition and showing off of a singer's capacities, which is what ornamentation was for. So while that has a tremendous amount of validity, I tend to go for things that kind of enhance the color, enhance the movement, enhance the dramatic content.
And I agree with Danielle that suit also one's personality and voice and seeing the thing. I mean, what's quite amazing also is to see the ones written by Handel himself or Handel singers or singers of his time. And it's quite extreme. It's quite extreme. And if you would perform those, at the moment they would even seem almost too much to our taste, so it's gradually daring and daring to be extreme and daring to be over the top. When you sing an aria that is very tragic, the second time round, it has to explore even further away. But you have to have, singers who have either studied or even not studied. You don't really need to study harmony. Some people just have a natural ear for that, a natural knowledge of it, weirdly. And you can right away say those who can have can go with this approach because they have that musical ear that would allow them to do so. And actually, Danielle is not because she's here, but no, she's really one of those, which is very, very nice. And so, by the way, is David, who has a very natural sense of ornamentation. So it's very nice.
You've both done this Glyndebourne production before. So what would you consider its greatest strengths? I mean, I know it had a spectacular success there. And so I just wondered how you would describe what makes it so different, especially, Danielle, having come from other productions. You just did this piece at the Met, and you had done it in Amsterdam, of course, and in Paris. So how do you contrast it with experiences that you've had in this piece before?
It's really... it's a production like nothing else that I've ever done in my life. And I'm so... still moved to be, to have been a part of it and to still be a part of it is such a special and just a thrilling experience. I think what makes this production really special is, as Emmanuel was saying when we first started talking, that it embraces the music and at the same time embraces the audience as well. So that there's no... I don't feel when I'm on stage that I'm sort of behind a glass wall and we're just performing with each other. It's really there to... It's a story that is told. And the other thing... I mean, the other thing. There are so many other things. Of course, there is the element of choreography, which distinguishes this production from other Julius Caesars that I've ever done. And the choreography also is there to enhance the color and the intention. And it's not... frivolously used either, and I think that is a very special thing about this production. The choreography is there to enhance what is already in the music, the dance qualities that you can find in Handel arias. But at the same time, there are these great moments of tragedy, of loss, of insecurity, that when Caesar sings Aure, time stands still. This is Aure de per pietà, which he sings when he's kind of, you know, almost shipwrecked and kind of barely surviving. And what's great is that those moments where there's no movement are just as touching as the moments where there are movements. So David McVicar and Andrew George, who did the choreography, David McVicar is the director, they have tremendous capacities in terms of exploring storytelling and really using the text and the music to really come to the real heart of what's being told. So it makes it, for us as performers... the most fulfilling experience to be in the staging, because there's not a moment that goes by that hasn't been thought about and really examined and explored. And the production breeds as well. So in doing this at Chicago Lyric, there are a few cast members that are doing it for the second or third time. And what's wonderful is that we're not sitting there in the rehearsals and listening to the director say, you have to do it exactly the way that you did it before because this was what we did before. Where the production is breathing and it's almost being reborn again. Changing ornaments also helps that. Changing choreography helps that. So the production really, I keep saying breathing, but it really breathes as a whole because it grows with us as we grow as singers, as we come back to a role again. And the success that it's had is I think, directly related to David and to the singers and, you know, to everybody that's involved, because it's an incredible amount of work and time that goes into preparing this production. And it does look... on the outside to be a seamless entity that just flows. And that's our job, is to make it look effortless. But it takes a lot of effort and a lot of rehearsal and a lot of time. And it's all worth it because, you know, we have a great time on stage with it as well.
Mm-hmm. Emmanuel, there's so much going on the stage in this production. Does that make your life in the pit more difficult or...
More interesting.
More interesting.
More.
I mean, some of those
challenging.
Some of those
more like how do you say? Well, le gardien but, le
goalkeeper.
When there is a penalty.
Yeah, the goalkeeper.
you've got to be ready because a lot of things.
It's true.
It's quite true. It's very physical, also a production. We've got some athletes. Christophe Dumont, who is doing the role of Tolomeo, is quite unbelievably fit. He's doing, you never know where he will end.
Maybe in the pit.
The backflips. So, he does backflips and he leaps onto a table and off a table. It's extraordinary.
So we have placed nets a bit everywhere to make sure. and Cleo is dancing, and the only danger is the member of the orchestras are very interested by what.
That's true.
Danielle, you get punched and shoved around by Ptolemy in Act 3 just before you have to sing one of the more difficult legato arias for anyone in the show, and that's Piangero.
Yeah.
So just sitting there in the audience, it's really harrowing to watch what goes on between the two of you. A little scary. So how do you go about staging that scene so that you're not injured and so that you can sing your aria?
Actually, I've just discovered that I might have tendonitis, which I might have gotten on stage during sort of battle scene in my thumb here. Injuries do happen sometimes. They usually just happen from the adrenaline because you don't really feel them when it's happening because you're just in the moment. It was incredible to stage that scene for the very first time in 2005 to explore the relationship between Ptolemy and Cleopatra, which you don't see in other Cesare productions. The other thing that you don't see in other Cesare productions is that Ptolemy is on stage when Cleopatra begins Piangero. So the entire first A section, it's so much more than just what she's singing, but she's also trying to make him feel sorry for her. So she's slightly pouting and manipulative and telling the truth at the same time. The scene that happens before, there are techniques that we learn about. There are also fight directors that come in to the rehearsal and show you what you need to do. So, for example, all of the times that I get pushed around...
And slammed.
Maybe I shouldn't say this. It's a trick of the trade. Well, there are ways in which one can control your movement. So it doesn't mean that I don't get hurt or that it doesn't look as bad as it is when I'm being thrown around. But when you can control your own body movement, you have a lot less chance of being really hurt. One of the ways that we do that is that, if, for example, if somebody's pushing me from this side to the right, they don't just push me, but we prepare. So we do this thing where you kind of go like this and then go. And that enables you to control the movement and control the speed at which you fall. It's a very tough scene to do before Piangero because it's very, very physical. There's a lot of hair pulling, and I've got, sometimes hurt my knee, hurt my elbow. I have to say, I was really proud of what we did in the scene because the fight director came up to me twice and said, "Are you okay? Did you hurt your elbow? Are you okay?" And I said, "No, that was just part of what I was just... I was acting it out." And I stayed with it even for the next scene. And he was very impressed, but I was patting myself on the back because it's tough. It's really tough to do that and then to sing after. And Christoph does it while he's singing. So, I'm being thrown around and then I have to sing after, so I'm exhausted after. But Christoph is actually doing all of that and singing at the same time, which, only we singers can hear each other gasping for air during those moments. But it is incredible. I go through it in the Tempeste and in the first two arias, where we're just going just for any air that will come in order to sing the next legato phrase. And it's tough. It's really, really tough. But I have to say, one of the things I like about doing that scene before Piangero is that there's so much action going on that I actually get very loose. So if I'm nervous about that scene, I don't have time to think about it because I'm too busy being pushed around and hit and knocked on, various parts of my body. And it leaves me actually kind of very low and loose in my body and quite ready for Piangero because I just don't have time to be nervous about it and tighten up.
Now, Emmanuel, there you are in the pit with this beautiful picture or series of pictures in front of you. It's there's so many images of this production that stay in one's mind. Mm-hmm. Do you have a particular favorite scene where you just love just looking at it?
Many. And anyway, when I perform such an opera, I'm driven by what's on stage, because I really do think that the orchestra is part of that. And I'm trying to make one body with what's going on there. We actually are very much raised quite high up, so that the distance can be as little as possible, and so that the players feel not only me, I am in front of them, I'm seeing them. Some of them can a bit. And in actually Baroque pits, they were playing the reverse. They were very high and they were playing to the singers. So the balance was always fine, because they were facing the singers. They were never too loud and they were seeing it. We're not doing it quite extreme way, but we are already raised very high and so part of what's going on there. And I must say that it's quite some scenes are very enchanting. The Vadoro Pupilli, the seductive scene that Cleopatra disguised in Lydia puts on for Caesar is absolutely breathtaking. I mean, for those who have seen the dress rehearsal or will see the first one, it's so beautiful. The set is particularly beautiful. The costume of Danielle is wonderful. She wears it very well, but it's really, really beautiful. It's just so charming. And the choreography is so perfect with the music, so it's really nice. You feel one part of one movement all together. And yeah, the I like very much also the scene of Caesar, the Saint Fiorito with the violinist. It's a very, very beautiful moment. The Londoso, all that is beautiful. Some of the scenes of Cornelia and Sesto duet, which is one of the most beautiful heart-breaking music, really. And it's so horrible. I mean, the Sesto have been beaten to death and who knows what. I mean, by the soldiers, she's been taken away. They are going to be taken apart in 1 second, and he's covered in blood, and they sing that arm in arm like if he would be a small baby. This is really heartbreaking. I mean, honestly, it's very beautiful. It's realistic playing, some of it, but in a Baroque inspired set somehow that has a lot of variety. Some of it is Roman a bit. Some of it is, I don't know where from. Like all your scenes when you start with all the veils is, where does it come from? Egypt, India, I don't know exactly.
Orient.
It's oriental,
yeah.
Colorful. Your costume as well as Tolomeo's costume is very beautiful when it starts.
Yeah. So. Danielle, you have 8 costumes in this show.
Yeah.
How do they... Can you talk about a few of them and just explain how they relate to your character at that particular moment?
What's great about the costumes, I mean, they are brilliantly designed, and what's great about the variety of them is that, it, in a sense, it does illustrate Cleopatra's many disguises, because she also kind of puts on certain kinds of faces for Caesar, for her brother, and for when she's just alone. She starts out in a sort of, as Emmanuel said, oriental style costume, Ptolemy as well, and then she sort of turns into a flapper girl for Lydia, which of course one could not relate to the previous costume, but it is kind of indicative of the different faces of Cleopatra, and she shows the other characters in the opera what she wants them to see. So I also have 6 wigs. So quick changes are incredible. There's about 4 people in there ripping things off, jewelry, collars, cuffs, bracelets, anklets, and then dressing me up from head to toe again, wigs as well, and even makeup changes. So it's incredibly complicated. And I even have a scene where I take a bath and then change my clothes on stage, which is another complicated affair.
While singing Handel Coloratura.
Yes.
You also have an extremely grand dress in which you end the opera.
Yes. It weighs a lot. It weighs about 40 pounds. We did the pre-general and they buttoned it up without the hip pad on. So I had 2 pieces of metal in my hip, which I still have a bruise from. It's very, very difficult to wear that dress, but as the costume designer and I agreed on before the premiere, it is worth it for the 15 minutes of suffering, and it's only at the end, she said. So, and I said, it's just too beautiful to say no to, so I did not, and it is difficult to sing. And then we did, when we were making the DVD, we had to find a place to put 2 microphone packs in that costume. So... And it didn't go under the skirt, so it was quite challenging.
Well, Emmanuel, do you know how this piece was cast?
Yes, I mean, of course, we all know that the castrato was the heroic role at the time and had to be, and the tenor became very late the primo uomo, and therefore in here it's quite on the contrary usual to have in a Italian opera all the castrati's with variety within their range, but representative either of the primo uomo in the case of Caesar and the really bad one in the case of Tolomeo. The bass was more, in any case, the villain, which he happens to be in the case of Aquila.
Yeah.
So.
And it's interesting that Sesto, you would think, would have been created by a castrato, but it wasn't. The role was created by a woman. Durastanti was one of Handel's favorite singers. Danielle, how accurate is it historically, the way, did Cleopatra use Caesar the way she does in the opera, or no?
It's a really tough thing to answer because I don't particularly remember reading any documented information where it was said that Cleopatra admitted love for Caesar. Cleopatra had Caesar's children as well. She bore a child for Caesar, and they were a couple. I think that she probably loved many things about him. It is definitely documented that, you know, Cleopatra's great love was Mark Antony, who she met after, had met once as a young child, but then met after Caesar's death. But as we know in life as well, one can be attracted to many different qualities in a person that can reveal themselves as love in one way or another. So sometimes I think that Cleopatra aligned herself with Caesar for the political alliance that she could gain from that. But power is attractive and security is attractive. She loved her father and she lost her father. So Caesar was slightly older than her and also provided a certain amount of security. So that is also a love, in a sense. Whether she found true passionate love with Mark Antony, sure. But at the time, I think that what she had was also some form of love.
The second question being, do you have on your resume that you're a ballet dancer?
I don't have that on my resume. I did train in dance, not as a professional at all, but I took jazz, ballet, tap dancing, modern dance, Spanish dance from the time I was 6. And they have come to help me tremendously in terms of this production. in another way, they hindered me because as a dancer, one tends to pull up and engage all of your abdominal muscles in very tightly. And as a singer, we're constantly studying our technique to keep low and loose and, you know, supported in a very different way that a dancer would support and keep their core strength. So if I had not had dance training, then I would be kind of doing these movements superficially. But having had the training, I tend to extend my energy out, you know, to the fingertips, as they always tell you in dance class. So that makes me exhausted at the end of these numbers because I'm really giving my all, and I also had to spend a lot of time practicing and figuring out how to pace myself when the moments are in the arias that I can be the singer and keep myself loose and buoyant, and when the moments are that I can pull up and keep my posture as a dancer.
We can take one more question. Hank.
I know David pretty well, but I was quite sheepish about kissing him so much when I found out that he was going to be doing it in 2006, because he's a man, and I felt much more comfortable on the stage kissing a woman where, you know, we didn't have any kind of, you know, I didn't feel threatened at all, and I didn't feel threatened by David either, but I did feel a bit shy about kissing him because he was a man, and it took David was very good at making me feel very comfortable, and it does change a bit.
Do you think differently as Cleopatra between your two seasons?
No, I find Sarah Connolly was absolutely incredible portraying a man, and for such a feminine woman, to see her on stage was to see another person, not to see Sarah. That's one of the great things about this profession, is that we can be someone else on stage and embody somebody else's body language in a different way. I had that experience doing L'Enfant et les Sortilèges at the Met because I played a boy. It was the first time for me. And so much changes of your body language, even the way that you hold your face as a woman, is very different from a man. Certain muscles here just relax. And, you know, it was a study for me to do. And so watching Sarah do it as well was just incredible. But I do feel I related to them in the same way because I treated them as the character and not as the person. You're welcome.
I look forward to seeing all of you at Giulio Cesare. Thank you so much, Emmanuel and Danielle.
Thank you. Thank you for coming.
You've been listening to Backstage at Lyric, the podcast that takes you behind the scenes at Lyric Opera of Chicago. Backstage at Lyric features interviews with the creative forces behind the productions in the 2007-2008 season. For additional interactive content and to order tickets, visit us online at lyricopera.org.